that. So if there was anybody out there in the universe that wanted to participate, we didn't want to just move down. Welcome. My name is James Sepplow. I am a program manager for the Department of Water Resources. I'm out of the Agricultural Falls office, however, so I drove over last night and glad to be here in person. I am one of the designated hearing officers for the department. We have a handful of people scattered throughout the state that can act as hearing officers. I generally handle contested cases in eastern Idaho, but occasionally I come over and do a little bit of work in the voice care. With me is Kitty White and Andy Blades, both from the department. I think you guys know them, probably cross paths with them more frequently than you do with me. What I wanted to do to start with is to go around the room and just do the records. We are recording this. So for the record, just keep track of who we have here at the meeting and start here.
Tim Page, Voice Project.
Okay.
Bob Carter, Voice Project.
Great.
Mike Lawrence with Givens Persley on behalf of Suez Water.
Chris Meyer with Givens Persley on behalf of Suez.
Roger Dittus with Suez.
Okay, great.
Kyle Raddick with City of Meridian.
Charles Hunsinger of Hunsinger Law, representing City of Meridian.
Great.
Albert Barker on behalf of the Boise Project.
Bryce Ferris with Sawtooth Law on behalf of Nampa Meridian Irrigation District and Settlers Irrigation District.
Mm-hmm. Abby Germain, legal counsel for the City of Boise.
Rich Rose, City of Kuna.
Great.
John Roland, Stantec, but transitioning to City of Boise.
Okay.
Chris Bromley, listening in, City of Boise.
Okay.
Cherise McLean, Star Sewer Water, MSBTA Law.
Okay, Cherise, why don't you come find a seat at the table? You're one of our active partners.
All right, today. I was trying to avoid it.
Great, so we are then missing Chris Jorgensen from the City of Middleton as a remaining active protest.
We were expecting him to call in. Mike Lawrence spoke with him yesterday. Any update on that?
No, I don't know. He was waffling whether to call in or attend in person. I expected him to do one of the other things.
Well, he may have tried and may have given up, but you know, he may try to get him on the phone. So, my goal for our meeting today, I know it's been a couple years since this group last got together about these contested cases. My goal for today is to try to organize this case in a way that we have a path forward and we know what bites we can take. I think we've got a pretty big element here. It's a lot of information, a lot of water rights, and try to see if there are different areas we can, a way to organize this to really move forward, take it maybe one bite at a time. One of the drawbacks of having me appointed as a hearing officer is I haven't been part of all of the previous proceedings, so I'm coming with a list of questions that, as I've read through the files that I have, but it might be stuff that you guys have already covered, and you know, so I apologize for that if this is all, some of this is redundant to from previous meetings. Why don't, Chris, you guys have put together a good summary of kind of what's brought us here. I think your 2017 summary and update is really good. I don't think you need to get into all the minute details of what water rights are in and out. What I want you to do is maybe provide an update as to where you see this contested case going moving forward.
Okay, happy to do that. Thank you very much. Well, we got started on this on May 4, 2001, so we're a little better than 16 years into this, and just for fun, show of hands, who's been engaged since the first status conference? We have a few long-lived people, but we have survived a lot of others. There are a lot of new faces around the table, part of the good news is that the what was once a very large group of protestants is now a smaller group, and Suez, I think, has learned the hard way of how important it is to reach out to other water users and water providers and provide a good, sufficient explanation of what it is we're up to. And we have been successful in large part in converting what were formerly protestants into interveners in support, but we're certainly not there yet, and we still have some active protesters. We want to do whatever we can to address their concerns. If there's any way that we can do that short of going into full-blown administrative litigation. We were first filed in 2001. There were a couple of updates. The final package was put together in April of 2003, and then it was stayed shortly thereafter, December. There was a long hiatus. We came back in 2012 with what we informally called the relaunch. There was a little bit of motion practice, including a motion by the Boise Project, a motion to dismiss that was denied in 2013. But it was denied in large part because the department said, well, the Boise Project raises a good point that that a lot has happened during that long hiatus, and Suez, then United Water, needs to provide a lot more information so that everybody can get their arms around what the portfolio is, what's going on, what's in, what's out. That resulted in the submission of, in 2013, of what we called the 2013 further submission. There was a very detailed statement that IDW, or we worked with IDW, our staff, to go through that, and that kind of outlined what has happened to the portfolio, most, what has happened in the Snake River Basin adjudication, which is the reason that we had this long hiatus. But it became apparent in 2013 that the then hearing officer, Gary Spackman, and as well as other parties, felt, and not unreasonably so, that given the long duration of time since the first 50-year forecast was developed, it was simply not going to be sufficient to rely on a forecast that was then 13 years out of date. Suez asked informally for a stay of these proceedings, and we re-engaged for what turned out to be an extended period of time in putting together a new 50-year forecast that everyone should have a copy of. By the way, I did bring additional copies of the key recent submissions, the new 2015-65 forecast, the new update statement, and the revisions to the update statement. So if anybody would like something to work with as we're talking through, just ask me. I have spare copies. Just a few words about that new revised forecast statement. It's the same duration of a 50-year forecast that was contemplated under the original filing, but moved out 15 years. So the new one starts at 2015, goes out to 2065. We re-engaged with John Church, the economist who's now at BSU, formerly was the chief economist for Idaho Power. He did the first one. He re-engaged and went through the process of developing that new forecast. That new forecast was brought down the trajectory for future demand significantly. And that was a function, really, of three different things, probably most significantly, the Great Recession, which was just a massive magnetic force pulling down future demand. In addition, there's a lot of new data. There's a lot of new data outside of Suez, most notably the 2010 census, the federal census, and then a whole lot of new Compass data. And then the third component of that is new data within Suez, which is another decade plus of pumping data. So that at that point, John Church had an enormous, much better database to work with. And so we went through that whole process, but we really wanted to make certain that we had the confidence of other parties, other participants, and ultimately the department. And so we fell back at that point and asked for that forecast to be reviewed by Don Reading. Don Reading, as many of you know, has been retained by some of the other parties to this and other matters, and we reached out to him in particular because the department had reached out to Don Reading, and Don provided the economic analysis and basis that went into the department's most recent guidance on how you go about doing RAF and forecasting. I think everybody knows what RAF is, reasonably anticipated future needs. And so we asked Don Reading to review the updated forecast by John Church. He had full access not only to John Church but all the data. And they went back and forth for months and months and months, tweaking things, asking questions, well, isn't there a better way to explain this? Shouldn't that be done? And so on. And then when we thought we were about done, that was about the time that the DCMI report came out. It was prepared by SBF, and in particular Christian Petrick. And that also encompassed a 50-year forecast of water demand in the Treasure Valley. We thought, holy cow, we better make sure that our new forecast jives with that one. And so we engaged with Christian Petrick, and the whole process went on for months and months and months. And there were further tweaks, and then we'd take them back and, okay, Don Reading, are you satisfied with this tweak? And so on. So there was an iterative process that took a whole lot longer than we had expected, but we are optimistic and indeed confident that at the end of that process, we have produced a long-term forecast that is reliable. Now, one of the concerns that has been expressed by some parties and some people at the department is that 50 years is an awful long time to look at. And one of the things that Sue Ennis has always said from the outset is, you agree, 50 years is a long time to look at it in the future. And Sue Ennis has always said, we view this 50-year forecast as not something that you carve in stone, but something that you update from time to time, you know, perhaps once a decade, whatever the department thinks is appropriate. And so we had suggested that Suez would be amenable to having conditions placed on any approval of the IMAP that would be what we loosely refer to as a reopener condition. Discussions with department staff, and this hearing and others had suggested that the department said, well, we're not sure that we have the authority to do that. And Mike Lawrence and I provided research and analysis suggesting that that was the case, but we thought, well, let's test that. And we went to Phil Resier, who used to be the chief counsel for IDWR, and now lives happily with his wife in Paris, or a suburb thereof, but is still engaged on a consulting basis on water rights work. And so we interacted with him over a long period of time and said, Bill, what's your take on this? And sure enough, he said, Chris, you're wrong. If the department staff is right, if there's legal counsel that we've interacted with to say, you know, there really is a problem here. Technically, there is some difficulty in having a reopener condition once the thing is locked down at the licensing stage that allows the quantity element to be reduced. But you can get to the same practical end by adjusting the planning horizon, shortening that if need be, that would then allow you to trim that back and essentially require Suez to give back some water if it turns out that all of this effort has resulted in numbers that are higher than anticipated and can no longer be justified. And so all of these documents are included as attachments to this 2065 master water plan so that parties in the department can look through and analyze them and see whether they add up or not. So the first part of those are talking about the actual forecast itself, and the last one is really different. The Phil Resier component deals not with the forecast numbers, but the question of whether there is a way to provide a level of comfort to the department and to other water users that this forecast is not going to tie up a resource for a very long period of time if it turns out that the forecast was overly optimistic. So what, maybe we should back up and say, what is the purpose of the IMAC? It's important to emphasize that the IMAP does not seek any new appropriation of water. Rather, it seeks to take the existing portfolio of water rights that has been approved now through the SRBA process and for the post-SRBA rights through the administrative process and bring them within the 1996 Municipal Water Rights Act through a process of transfers for existing rights and amendments for existing permits. It would accomplish three things, basically. One is cleanup. There are a number of rights that have inconsistent service areas, inconsistent nature of use, and volume limits that we would like to have removed. Those volume limits relate primarily to water rights that came in as non-municipal water rights acquired from other sources. We'd like to have those removed because it's difficult to quantify and manage if you try to keep track of individual water rights rather than on a global basis, and that's done very simply without injury by reducing the diversion rate. The biggest and most important is APODs, alternative points of diversion. There are really three kinds of APODs or groups of APODs that are contemplated in these transfer applications. The biggest and the most significant is what we've described in the most recent submission as the global APOD, which is a group of what is now 80 wells. It was 81 the last time we were here. Some of those wells have come and gone, but the number is now 80. And those would be, that would allow every groundwater right to be pumped from any other groundwater right, or excuse me, from any well within United Water, now Suez's system, to provide the flexibility that would be necessary in the event of curtailment if Suez faced a situation where it could only pump its most senior water rights and wants to be able to pump them from whatever wells it thinks is correct, and that might rotate from day to day during the course of a week. There are conditions that Suez has agreed to that are intended to prevent injury, the elimination of the so-called super well that will allow you to pile up a lot of water rights and cause injury to other water users. That's the big one. That's the global APOD. Then there are two mini APODs, and these are really just kind of at the footnote level. One mini APOD is for the RANI collector rights. There are four RANI collectors, all right next to each other, that serve the Martin treatment plant. They are deemed groundwater rights, so we all know that they pull in some water from the Boise River. Only one of them is included in the IMAP, because that was the only one that was known at the time that the IMAP was first filed. The other three we've taken out because we wanted to avoid re-noticing the entire IMAP. Those were ones that came into existence during the scope and process of the Snake River Basin adjudication. And so the very simple thing that we want to do with the one that's still in is it's just a clarification that it can pump from any of the four RANIs that are right next to each other within the same quarter. So that's, again, kind of at the footnote level. But the important part is that the RANI collector wells are not included in the global APODs. So there's no possibility that Suez could take its other groundwater rights and start saying we're going to take them out of the RAND collectors, thereby implicating an argument as to what happens, you know, vis-a-vis interactions with the Boise River. And we've been, and we appreciate the fact that this has been called to our attention by Bryce and others, and we've really worked hard with Bryce's clients to try to address that concern, and I hope we've made some progress along those lines. The other mini APOD is a surface right, but there's only one surface right included in all of the IMAP. There are other surface rights that are not included, but there's only one that happens to be included, and that's for the also serves the Martin treatment plant, and we just want to add the additional point of diversion for the Columbia treatment plant to that one, so that you could take it out of the Boise River at either point. There is one other surface water right in Boise's portfolio. That's for the Columbia treatment plant, and it already has, if you will, this mini APOD, so that it can come out of either Martin or Columbia River. So there's no, so it's not in the IMAP. Doesn't need to be in the IMAP. It's already taken care of. But again, that's a footnote. The important part is there's no interaction there with the larger so-called global APOD. So there's no possibility that Suez would be able to use the approval of the IMAP to take additional water out of the Boise River or vice versa. So let me just say a couple words about the status of, you know, what the overall projection is, and then I'll stop talking. As I mentioned, the growth trajectory has dropped, and the last time we were here, we were predicting a peak demand 50 years out, which was then year 2050, of 416 CFS. The current projection for the year 2050 has dropped 132 CFS off of that, down to 284 CFS. But we pushed out the end of the planning horizon 15 years to the year 2065. Even doing so still produces a number that is lower than we were projecting for our 50-year needs the last time we were here, a number of 371 CFS, which is still 45 CFS lower than our future demand was the last time we sat in this room. That equates to an annual growth rate of 1.85%, which is modest. The department's guidance, its RAFN guidance, says that if you are anticipating growth of 2.5% or more, we consider that fairly aggressive, and you will need to provide background explanation and documentation of why your growth rate is above 2.5%. Ours is substantially below 2.5%, but as you can see, we have gone the extra mile, if not the extra marathon, to provide the documentation for why that 1.85% is justified. That equates to an increase of 2.5% of the total quantity over a period of 50 years, not in 1 year, but over the entire 50 years. Basically, that's a little bit more than doubling the current peak demand that Suez is experiencing today. So how does that relate to Suez's current portfolio? Suez's current portfolio is 331 CFS. I just said that the future demand is 371 CFS. It's close. That's a spread of 40 CFS. There's a 40 CFS gap there. Suez is not seeking to fill that 40 CFS gap through this process. Rather, Suez anticipates over the course of time filling that 40 CFS gap through voluntary transactions with folks like the parties that are here, with irrigators. In the long run, we anticipate that Suez's water needs are going to come more and more from the Boisson River and less from groundwater. And so we think it's very important, and frankly, to the benefit of everyone in this room, indeed everyone in the Treasure Valley, to have some gap there so that we can engage in voluntary transactions that are win-win situations for Boise to be able to fill in what is now a very modest gap. So we're anxious to hear from other parties as to where we are. We have two motions that are pending. We can talk about those as you direct, Mr. Hearing Officer. And then the larger question is, where do we go from here? We would very much like to continue the process of resolving concerns of protestants informally, as we have done very successfully with so many people around this table, and many that are not here at all because they've been sufficiently resolved, they've completely left the proceedings. If there's any opportunity to do that with the irrigation districts and others that remain in an active level of protest, we welcome a mechanism to do that. And the hearing officer may want to consider requiring protestants to provide some sort of explanation of what their concerns are and how they might be addressed. Now we can accomplish that informally through that process, or if need be, through a formal discovery process. So we'll leave that up to the hearing officer and input from the other parties. Ultimately, we are ready to go. We have front-loaded this process through what we consider to be an enormous amount of documentation and explanation, much more so than the last time we sat in this room in the 2012 era when we did the first relaunch. We basically walked in here and said, hello, everybody. It's been a long time. What should we do? Probably a lot of things have changed. We have not approached it that way this time. This time we have done all of the work we think that is necessary to allow us to go to hearing next week. Of course, that's not going to happen. We understand that. But we do expect, if there is a continued level of active protest, we need to go to hearing within the next year. And we are prepared to work through a calendar that would accomplish that. Thank you.
Great. Just to note, we had Chris Jorgensen join. I think, Chris, are you with us?
Yeah, apologize for the confusion. I got a bad certificate code, but I'm on now.
Oh, I apologize for that. Chris Myers just walked us through kind of a lot of what he had in his 2017 update in summary. And so we're just at the point where we're asking kind of what are the next steps in addressing this contested case. I have a number of questions, Chris. There were some protestants that have already withdrawn. When those protests were withdrawn, were they conditioned on the inclusion of certain conditions on the water rights, or they were withdrawn without condition?
Without condition.
Okay.
Now there have been, in a couple of instances, let me clarify that, there were site agreements that basically were cooperation agreements where Suez promised to have annual meetings and make sure that nobody was surprised by things, and there was just a heightened level of cooperation between Suez and other municipal providers. But to answer your direct question, no conditions that would be that would implicate IDWR or be placed on the record.
That can be complicated when you have a number of protestants and some drop out early on and have conditions, and the other protestants may or may not agree with those conditions. Yeah, it's kind of tricky. So we don't have that situation here. That's good. Tell me, when you talk about Rapid being, I guess, added to certain water rights, such as water rights that have already been pre or licensed, Are you envisioning that there will be a certain set of conditions that will be included on those water rights, and that's what will make them Rapid water rights moving forward?
Well, the way I perceive it is the department may well wish to do that. And the one that particularly comes to mind is there might be some sort of a reopener provision that says Suez needs to come back whenever we tell you or once a decade or something like that and provide an update on what your forecast is. So I can imagine that there might be a condition, but I don't think that that's a requirement. I think that's just a practical thing that the department might elect to do. In other words, the department, if it chose, could simply say, these are recognized as draft and water rights. This is the planning horizon. It begins at this year, ends at this year. This is the planning area, which is the future service area. And this is the quantity based on that. And you could stop right there.
So that seems to be an action outside of the transfer process. Is that what you're suggesting, that the department takes some sort of action, I don't know, an order declaring these to be wrapped in water rights and without adding conditions?
Well, perhaps I'm misunderstanding what you mean by conditions. Simply the description of the planning area and the duration, the planning horizon, and the long-term quantity, those would be, if that's what you mean by conditions.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
When the department it has issued draft law rights, there's kind of a standard set of conditions that are included that kind of flag it or identify it as a draft law right. So that's what I'm asking. Is that the goal of these, one of the goals of the transfers, to have those, I guess, draft and conditions?
Yes, you are. That would be precisely probably the central goal.
Are any of Suez's decreed or licensed water rights currently wrapped?
No.
None. So none were developed that way back in the day. And none of the permits, I know that we've got a set of 8 permits that are still included in this proposal, none of those are currently identified as wrapped.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. And part of the reason for that is that we've always assumed that the department really can't approve them as RAF and rights without understanding the whole portfolio. You can't do that on an incremental basis, and we've been at this for 16 years.
Tell me, and this is maybe my lack of understanding with just the RAF process, we don't get a lot of these in Eastern Idaho. The cities don't employ this method in Eastern Idaho. Most of them, you know, they maybe buy out a groundwater irrigation right and then put it in the supply bank use that as kind of forfeiture protection in the interim until they need it. So I haven't been exposed to a lot of RAF and water rights. Suez has a current demand, peak demand, and I don't know what that's not apparent in here. I guess it's something less than 300, maybe 200, 250. I don't know what its current demand is. But as you look at the portfolio of water rights, you know, the first 50 water rights, I don't know what it may be, could be used, the 50 most senior water rights could be used just to meet its current demands, and those seem to match up. So would those 50 water rights need to be identified as RAF water rights? Because arguably they're being used to meet the current demand, not in some future. Any thoughts on that?
Well,
did that question make sense?
It does, Your Honor, and I guess my inclination would be that it would be simpler for the department to simply identify the entire portfolio as RAF. And RAF, to me, and I'm not sure if I'm completely on the same page with IDWR staff and counsel on this. I think the department has thought of individual water rights as being RAFN or non-RAFN. To me, it makes more sense, since the whole concept of RAFN is a portfolio-wide analysis and a system-wide demand analysis, to say, well, either the system is in or not, and particularly if a municipal provider is willing to go through those steps, it seems to me that you just say, well, the whole portfolio is subject to RAFN. Maybe that's academic to the extent that, you know, in your hypothetical 50 of the most senior rights are being pumped 24 hours a day. Well, you don't really need it. but it seems to me it would be confusing and it would just be something that would raise more questions in the long run if you identify some water rights as RAFID and some as non-RAFID. We don't anticipate this happening very often, but there may be instances where water rights would need to be swapped in and swapped out of the portfolio. And it could be that we want to do a deal with one of the irrigation entities and bring in a big chunk of water. The department says, well, that's a mighty big chunk of water. What are you going to give up? Because, you know, now you're in excess of your 50-year demand projection. And we might say, well, we'll give up some water rights, but presumably we'd be giving up the junior ones. But it just seems to me it would be simpler to say that the entire portfolio is now described as RAFID rather than scratching our heads about what that means.
My thoughts are is that protestants' primary objection is dealing with the planning horizon and this concept of RAFID. You can kind of chop off a whole bunch of water rights and say, well, they can just move forward with the alternate APOD, you know, conditions and not deal with RAFID, and it kind of narrows the scope of the proceeding. But it sounds like you're viewing it more in portfolio. We're going to treat all of these water rights together.
Well, to me, that's the more logical way, but we are open to suggestions. And if there's some way of facilitating the path forward, we are all ears.
Another, I have a whole set of questions on permits. I find that 8 permits are kind of complicated. I find that of the 8, all 8 have had proof of beneficial use filed already. And the way that the water right process works, of course, is once you file proof of beneficial use, you're kind of locked in. That water right, no further development can take place under the water right. And so what you're proposing in this is to add points of diversion to those permits that have already gone, have proof of beneficial use filed. Generally, the department doesn't entertain transfer applications, or I guess I should say amendments to permits, after proof of beneficial use has been filed, mainly because that's kind of, they're locked into whatever exists for that permit. I think I would prefer to see those permits brought to license, and then have, if licenses are issued for those 8 permits, then have those included in the transfer, in a license form rather than in a permit. In fact, I was interested, I contacted our Western Regional Manager. 4 of those 8 permits have actually had a field exam completed by the department. And so I don't know why they haven't been licensed, but they definitely could be brought to license, and I guess is within 6 months to a year. The other 4 would require a beneficial use field exam where some coordination with department staff to be back completed. Any, from the protestants, any thoughts on those permits? Those jumped out to me as kind of particularly sticky just because I think they're much easier to deal with in license form than they are in permit form. Anything? Okay. Coming back to, do you have any concerns with that idea?
Not immediately, Your Honor. Frankly, I had not thought about that issue before. But if there's, there's more than one way to skin a cat, and if going to licensing first is more efficient, particularly if nobody else objects.
I think it is, and I would need to maybe light a fire in the Western region and push those up on the priority list and get them licensed. And I don't know that they are in the queue right now to be licensed, but we can definitely push to make that happen sooner than later. When you have come up with your total portfolio projection, so your total portfolio of existing water rights of 331, that's taking all those 8 permits at face value, right? At the maximum rate of the permit. So they may be licensed for something less. That happens, and so it's really effective current portfolio. And I think that's why it makes sense to take them as licenses. You know exactly what we
do. That makes sense, Your Honor.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I will do that after we break from this meeting. I'll contact our Western region, or maybe people here in the state office who are in charge of licensing to get those moved out of the queue. Can you talk for just a little bit more about the RAMI collector system? That's a separate system. Four wells, is that what it's made up of?
Those minor sharing.
There's three RAMI collectors.
I apparently misspoke earlier.
What does that mean? A collector well, and what's the water used for?
The RAMI collectors supply the surface water treatment plant that also has a surface water intake, and they're shallow wells with radial screens going out from them.
So do they become mixed water for the treatment plant?
Well, that's a legal question and a non-legal question. So I think the legal answer is it's groundwater.
It's groundwater.
Right.
But they're used in the processes of the
treatment.
They're
filtered ledges. Right. Really, really, really shallow wells.
Right.
And there's
at
a
the river.
At the drinking water treatment.
Correct.
Oh, I'm thinking it's a wastewater treatment.
None of this has to do with
Yeah, we have two treatment plants, and that is, I should have clarified, because when you say treatment, particularly when municipalities talk about treatment, they're talking about sewage cleanup.
Yeah.
And so this is basically the groundwater, correct me if I misstate anything here, Roger, but groundwater by and large is not treated. There may be some very special exceptions for that, but it doesn't go through a treatment plant.
Most of them don't.
But because this is shallow groundwater,
yeah, I mean, these collector wells were there before the surface water treatment plant was built, and so it just goes right in to the water treatment plant, undergoes the same process.
So, Roger, are you saying back in the day, before the water treatment plant was built, the RAMI collectors provided water directly into the system without any treatment.
Right.
But since you had the treatment plant there, you figured, well, we might as well
treat that. Right. We actually had another collector well farther to the west that the concern was, should they undergo more treatment than just a regular deep municipal well? And so we let go of one of those because, you know, there wasn't room to put a plant there.
Does it make sense? Is it possible to isolate those water rights, isolate those wells? Because you're saying they really aren't involved in the other AOD big group. Is it possible to isolate those water rights and wells into a separate proceeding, separate transfer application? I don't know if it makes sense. I don't know if protestants have specific concerns with the RAMI collector, or if that's a place that it could be kind of parceled out and let those pieces move forward. But those water rights, you would still want to be identified as Rathman water rights.
Well, yeah, I think that's true.
So we don't avoid, I guess, that whole may simplify the APOD questions, but
Your Honor, correct
me if I'm wrong, I believe we only have the one RAMI collector right in the proceeding.
And
a single water right. And the only thing we're looking to do with that is that mapping protection is to allow it to be used in any of the three RAMI collectors.
But to follow up, Your Honor, on your suggestion, and allow me to think out loud, and also allow me to change my mind if I do this to a different conclusion later, but thinking out loud, if it would facilitate the expedition of the IMAP, I should think that Suez would be willing to take out both the RAMI collector water right, and for that matter, the surface water right. And say, look, someday we'll come back and there'll be a cleanup proceeding once we get the forecast approved, and we'll scoop that other stuff in, because there are a handful of other rights I think that are out there that are not having to clean up. You know, frankly, we haven't suggested that because we're just fearful. We don't want to come in and say, oh, one more change. But if the hearing officer thinks it's a good idea, then we don't have to have the burden of suggesting it.
Those two components definitely bring different issues, and I don't know whether there are major issues with the protestants, probably with the surface water right, just because a lot of protestants are surface water users, that the random collector wells may be out there without any major issues of protest associated with there. Bryce, any thoughts?
Well, you know, the way Chris has broke this out, the APOC condition, he added in these three different categories, and we've been trying to address each of these categories with Chris. We've met, you know, the global one, and how that impacts us, the RAND collectors, how that impacts us. And then the surface water rate is essentially a transfer to add a point of diversion. But he raises a good question, how is it going to fit into this RAFN portfolio? But at least for purpose of the APOD, you're just saying add a point of diversion for this upstream location, which is the Columbia treatment plant, right?
So that's correct, Bryce.
I haven't really, I mean, like I say, we've tried to tackle them on these three different levels, but I haven't really got to this question where the RANI and the surface water rights, how do they fit into this RAFN portfolio that you're going to put together or ask for? And whether or not there's going to be conditions on those separate rights that have some RAFN conditions that you explain the department typically uses. So I don't know if I have a good answer for you at this point.
Okay.
I know we've been looking at them as three separate categories, if you will, because that's the way you presented them to us, as three separate categories. So we've been trying to address them as one, two, and three. Whether they're all included in one or they go separately as three different items, I don't know if it makes that much of a difference, other than we're just trying to address them separately that way.
Your Honor, one thought does cross my mind, which is that in order to bring something within the RAFN process, if it's an existing water right, you need to go through a transfer process, and there needs to be something to change other than just adding RAFN, which is just a peculiarity of whoever drafted this silly statute back in 1996. And so with groundwater rights, it's pretty easy to always have something, because, you know, there'll always be some new well that we'll add, and then we can go back and, you know, redo the entire portfolio on the groundwater side. For these surface water ones, we may not be adding a new point of diversion for surface water for who knows when. And so if we take out the margin surface right and say, oh, we'll clean that up later, I'm not sure that we can add RAFN later. We could do it. Well,
file a transfer application.
Well, that would be a transfer application.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Well, it's an interesting proposal to remove those two water rights out of the proceeding, and it narrows, I guess, the focus, eliminates a lot of the river issues with that surface water right. Alan, thoughts? We've kind of talked through some of the options here. Any ideas?
Well, from the Boise Project perspective, they take their water out above all of these locations, so the change in points of diversion on the surface water right upstream to Columbia is probably not as an issue for us as it would be for Nampa Meridian, because they're moving the water right up above their point of diversion, and that, you know, to me is something you got to be really careful about. Is that water right a permitted right, or is it a licensed right, decreed right?
I believe it's permitted.
That's the 96, right? 94, right?
3.
And I guess for me, the same thing is true about the RANI collectors. I might disagree with Chris about whether that's effectively a groundwater right or not, since it just takes water out from underneath the bottom of the river that otherwise would have been in the river. But it's still downstream from our point of diversion. Street. So if he moves it from one place to another down there at Barton Street, it doesn't affect the Boise project water. So I'm not sure I'd have a lot to say either way about that. And I'm not sure if these are in fact, if they're pulled out or not. I'm not sure we have much of an issue with changing point of diversion. And I guess we may have an issue about trying to turn these into future deeds rights if they are in fact already being used. And if they're not already being used, maybe they should be future deeds rights. But I thought the Randy collectors had been in use for decades, if not longer. So I'm not quite sure I understand why that needs to be set aside as a future deeds right.
Comes back to that same question I have, which is, do certain individual water rights need to be identified as wrapping rights, or what's the argument used?
No, I think that's a very good question. With the portfolio this big, is that are really all 400, 371, whatever the number is, CFS, all future needs, when back 200 of them are actually being put to use? Is that an appropriate way to use the future needs statutes, particularly if United Water has the ability to take water from any one of its wells and call it an existing water right anyway? I mean, to say that it's using its existing rights, it seems to me that, I guess it's not, I'm not the one making the request, but it seems to me that if I were pumping 200 CFS and wanted to set aside another 150, I'd say I only need 150 for future needs, and I've got 200 that I'm actually putting to use, so that that would be immune from forfeiture. I guess the theory is future needs rights are immune from forfeiture too, for some period of time.
Tell me, Chris, I know that you were involved in when the legislation created the wrapping idea. Has Suez considered using the water supply bank as the mechanism to avoid forfeiture wrap? I mean, maybe this is a horrible question now that you probably poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into a planning horizon, but why not just use the water supply bank as the protection against forfeiture rather than the wrapping?
Suez's approach is long-term on this. And, the water supply bank may be there today, maybe there next year, maybe there 2 years from now. But we don't know what's going to be happening with the water supply bank over the long run. What we can predict over the long run is that there are going to be larger and larger water battles. To a large extent, Idaho has been immune from these compared to what is going on throughout the rest of the Western United States in any event. The water battles that we've had here have been microscopic by comparison. In the long run, we anticipate both more fights within Idaho among water users as new energy projects or who knows what come online, and people look around and say, well, there are some people here that aren't really using their supplies, and we can put them to use today. In addition, we anticipate battles between states, interstate conflicts. And we think that it's important not only for Suez, but really for everyone in the state of Idaho, certainly everyone who's represented in this room, to have a very clearly defined, staked out procedures for municipalities to identify their long-term needs and have that put through a process that is rigorous, reviewed by the department based on sound planning, so that if we get into a battle with Washington State or anyone else, whoever the special master is going to say, well, that all that paper you own
suggest that you're not putting to good use today is pie in the sky, and we're not going to honor it.
Well, that's an interesting thought, and to use the water supply bank, I guess, as a forfeiture protection. You really are subject to the changes in the water supply bank, and those changes, although they are common, they do occur every now and then, and you're kind of subject to the whims of the Water Resource Board as to how that structure, I guess, having wrapped it be a component of the water rights and affords a little bit better protection. Charisse? Did you have anything to add to our conversation we had about some of these other issues, the Randy Collector or the surface water right?
No. I mean, I kind of echo exactly what you just brought up of why bring in current use into a RAFN. I mean, my clients that have RAFN applications or RAFN water rights didn't get that luxury. I mean, we had to prove up what we currently use and then have to prove up why. And we use the Compass forecast, so I agree with the methodology. I'm still struggling with the 50-year planning horizon and still struggling with how the administration worked with the APODs during a water loan recall. So I'm still pretty conceptual of the issues. So I don't have any issues on the surface water.
Chris, on the phone. Anything to add to that discussion about the Randy Collector or the surface water rights?
I don't have anything to add.
Okay. So some things to chew on. I think that is an interesting legal question, which is should the water rights that are needed for current demand be included in a proposal, a RAFN proposal? I mean, they need to be included in the calculations. That's not what I'm asking. But should they be designated as RAFN water rights?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Before we get away from the Randy Collectors, make sure I understand the plumbing. So you're describing that there's these shallow wells that then divert water into the surface treatment plant. Is the plumbing of that separate from the surface water right diversions that you would have out of the river? At least until they get to the surface treatment plant, how do they intermix with each other?
I don't know the blueprint exactly, but I believe they have separate pumps, obviously, and they pump into right into the plant. They don't pump into the surface water intake outside of the plant. I believe they go into the plant.
So does that mean that then the Randy Collector pump diversion will divert water into the surface treatment plant some method, and then there's a separate pipe plumbing system for the diversion from the river for Suez's separate surface water rights?
Yes. Yeah, there's a separate surface water intake.
They get commingled as they get into the treatment
plant. Yeah, and I don't know exactly what the Randy Collectors require would require significantly less treatment. I mean, it's not the same water. The hydraulically, the drawdown curves on those don't respond like they are getting recharged right in that particular area. And I know that's something that was argued about in the past when they came up with the proportioning for what percentage would be considered surface water and groundwater. But the main reason that they go right into the plant is because the plant has a big booster pump that can put it out into the system. And so they come from the collectors into the plant separately and I don't believe they commingle with the surface water intake outside of the plant. But that's something I'll look into.
Bryce, I can't figure out what the concern is. Happy to provide the information, but is one better than the other from your client's perspective?
Well, I'm just trying to understand the Randy Collectors. You view them as being groundwater. Sounds like they're.
Well, I'm not really prepared to explore that whole legal question because that's a bit of a.
Well, without getting into that, the question he was asking was kind of the plumbing and how those worked.
Right.
And that raised a question for me is, where does the surface water intake fit into that? Is it just somewhere separate, coming out of the river. It's a diversion pipe out of the river. They don't intermix at all until they get into the treatment plant. Is that?
I believe that's the case.
I'm just trying to figure out if that's the plumbing of how these random collectors mingle or don't mingle with the surface water diversion.
Well, let us know if we can. I guess you'd like us to pin that down.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe you could look into that and see if they do or where they do.
Yeah. Yeah.
That'd be great.
Tell me from the protestants, I want to shift now into the APOD conditions. According to this 2017 summary, it sounds like a fair number of Suez's water rights already carry these APOD conditions from the adjudication process through the decrees. I know the court has looked at that, so a lot of them are limited in that way, but say this right was originally used at this well, this location, this amount. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are there, and now you're wanting to, I guess, take, and a lot of these are, have 40 points of diversion, I think, on them, and so you're wanting to up that to now the full 80 wells. Are there concerns of the protestants with that component of the proposal? And if so, can you talk me through kind of what those concerns entail? Go ahead, Bryce, we'll start with you.
Well, again, I've looked at this as Chris and I have met and gone through this, the APOD condition with these three different categories. And the global one, the 80 wells, I think for the most part, I haven't seen what these conditions look like. Even the department standard conditions, and I would like to see those. But Chris, for the most part, has addressed what concerns we would have with the APOD condition on the 80 wells. We've met at least once, gone over the locations of them and some other aspects of them. Like I say, I would like to see what those conditions are and how they actually read. The Ranny collectors, I'm not quite as... still trying to understand. I guess it's three wells that now you're wanting to be able to divert the one right. Not quite understanding the proposal that you want to include for the Randy collectors, so I'm not quite there on that. And the surface water right, again, I just view it as you're adding a point of diversion, and as Al points out, the impact there would be it's in both cases it's above Settlers Irrigation District's diversion, but it's basically moving a point of diversion from what is currently below the Ridenbaugh to above the Ridenbaugh. And so there's maybe some issues there that we would need to explore. So again, just trying to break it down into those three different categories. Category one, global. Like I say, I think other than seeing what those conditions would look like, we've been able to meet with Chris and for the most part try to address those.
Are diversions off the Boise River measured by and regulated by a water master?
Yep.
Yes. Okay.
So you can look at the data and say if it does move upstream, that they're not enlarging the use, that it still is limited to the same amount as what it would have been. Al, did you have on the APOD condition front, do you have concerns with that global APOD?
So I can't remember, Chris, how long ago it was we sat down in our office and looked at the maps and had a pretty good sense of where things were, and I have to admit, I don't remember everything we talked about back then. I think we had identified a well or two that we wanted to do some further exploration about, and I think one of them was at Hillcrest, which is basically sits right on the shoulder of the canal. I don't remember that we had a whole lot of other issues. Tim, do you remember any wells that... So it would probably be worthwhile for us to sit down again together, Chris, and look at a couple of those things. But I think in the meantime, of course, we had a Supreme Court decision in the City of Pocatello case that identified how this would work. And I don't understand, Chris, to be asking for anything different than what the Supreme Court said is what... isn't appropriate, and I probably don't want to revisit that issue with the Supreme Court. So for us, there may be one or two little things to talk about, but I don't have a big problem with it.
Excellent. And if Chris, if you could send Bryce, then maybe some conditions. I mean, I think they already exist under water rights. So you can identify this as kind of the standard that we would expect moving forward.
Yeah, they are in these documents.
Yeah, if you go back in time a little ways to the United Water Statement updated and explained that we launched from 2012.
Oh, God, I forgot to bring that one.
On page 28, reading on page 28 of that document, there's a whole section that discusses that.
Have those changed now that the departments changed their conditions? And
there may have been a little bit of tweaking in language, and I can definitely send out email the current version of that standard condition.
Yeah, that would be great.
But it would be pretty slight.
That should be what we have. Right, that should be.
The concept, do you want me to say a word about the concept, or
no, that's fine. Let's move on. I think people can understand that it's pretty self-evident when you read people language, but I'll send out an email with that. And of course, if there are concerns with specific wells, one that might be right there on the edge of a canal, you know, it's easy to address that for a condition too, to limit a specific well to maximum diversion rates. We see that all the time, of course. Say this well can never pump more than 4 CFS, and that way you're protected from.
I suspect that well's old enough that it probably can't pump.
Yeah.
We decree it.
Well,
it is.
You had talked about, Chris, you said, at the beginning, you had said that Suez was willing to accept some sort of a limit or a condition preventing the development of a super well. What do you mean by that, and what would that look like?
Your Honor, I didn't mean anything different than the APOC, the standard APOC language. In other words, well, technically Suez could develop a super well, but if it did and it caused localized interference, it would be deemed to be injury.
Because you'd be tied to that original rate, that original priority date of continuing down that well, and a lot of it would probably be wasted money in development because you'd be chopped back down.
Exactly right.
That would defeat the purpose of your alternative points of diversion to get water to different parts of the system if you all had to get
the system's not set up to use a super well.
As a practical matter, there will never be a super well.
No super bugs either.
So, Charisse, is turning to your clients, specific concerns with the APOD element of the proposal or not?
No. No, my
plans are trans.
So,
okay. And Chris, on the phone, any specific issues with that element of the proposal, APOD cross-listing points of diversion on the water rights? Okay, well, that's interesting. I wasn't quite sure, not having sat through the previous meetings, whether that was going to be a major issue. So it seems like the thrust of protests are directed to the fracking elements of the proposal. And if we were to go to hearing, we'd probably spend quite a bit of time in that planning horizon and talking, having technical experts review the data and agree or disagree with certain elements of that report. Does that help you guys? I mean, to know that, I guess, that the APOD portion of that the proposal is a really good issue.
That helps a lot, Your Honor.
Okay. So,
we're always glad to help.
We can stop writing so much.
Is your hand getting tired, Mike?
So then let's talk about where we go from here. I feel pretty strongly that these permits that are pending before the department need to be licensed before we make any major decisions on adding points of diversion to those licenses. Like I said, I'll try to get those moved up in the queue. My guess is that it will take at a minimum of 6 months, especially because some of them need field exams, and that would take some coordination with the city to come in and measure wells or whatever's needed on that project.
Mr. Officer, if I could just ask a question. It doesn't occur to me, but correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't occur to me that the issuance of a license, which you recognize, may actually result in a lower diversion rate or volume limit on some of these rights, that would require the advertising.
No, it would. It doesn't. I mean, the license, issuing the license, of course, is an action of the department and is subject to a 1701A hearing request. So I can't say that those wouldn't have some sort of bumps in the road, but my guess is that it would be a piece of the process.
Right, I wasn't speaking specifically to re-advertising those rights for purposes of licensing. I mean, if they go from permit to license within the duration of this proceeding, will this proceeding need to be re-advertised?
Will not. If those licenses were issued for a lesser amount, no, we would not re-advertise. We would just take the rights as they exist.
Well, you hope you don't have to be re-advertised, because the department has advertised proceedings going from permits to license.
Sometimes, yeah. There are significant changes. Sometimes we go out and find that the beneficial use developed is a little bit different than what was contemplated at the time of the permit, but I think all of these permits were identified as municipal use, which is a pretty broad use. Okay, so we will do that. So that may be at least, like I said, 6 months out for handling a licensing. What would you want to have happen in the interim?
Well, Your Honor, I would hope that we would just move forward at full speed in the interim, because it seems to me whatever happens to those licenses that'll affect the gap analysis at the end of the day, but it will not affect the 50-year planning horizon and all the analysis that accompanies that.
Okay. That's correct. I agree. Because there's a lot of data involved in the planning horizon and technical expertise, my guess is that the parties will want to engage in some discovery in advance of the hearing. I don't think that any discovery has taken place in this case yet, even back in the 2003 time period, the parties engaged in discovery.
Seems to me there was a little bit, but whatever it was, it would be outdated today.
Changes. That's right. Okay. So does it make sense for us to then open up a discovery window maybe during this time period that licensing is being reviewed?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, I should say that, perhaps with greater optimism than is justified, that Suez would love to be able to continue to work with other parties informally, and we're happy to make John Church and others available on an informal basis if Protestants think that would be more efficient. But we don't want to do that in a way that simply then pushes out the hearing. In other words, we don't want to go through that exercise informally and say, well, now we need to do it formally. If we could have maybe we should hear a little bit from the Protestants, but if a short round of informal interaction might be sufficient to actually resolve concerns, then we ought to do that. If that's not realistic, then we ought to just move immediately to formal discovery.
Have you guys, Protestants, had a chance to sit down with Mr. Church and talk through his report yet?
No, I would agree with Chris. I think a short period of time to talk and see if there are ways to either narrow or resolve some of the issues. To the extent you're suggesting that if we do that, we're precluded from engaging in formal discovery, and I don't think that's what he was saying, then I wouldn't want to do that. But I do think giving us a couple, 3 months to talk, sit down, and then if we're looking at 6 months out for the rest of that, then it would be a substantial amount of time. I mean, for the licensing process to work through, there'd still be 3 months or so to do formal discovery. So I'm not proposing a timeline, but it sounds like something like that makes some sense instead of spending more money than we need to if we can resolve it short of having to do formal discovery.
You bet. That's a good idea.
That work, Chris?
Yes, I think so. I think what's important to Suez is that we, you know, really put this on the front burner. And so I think, you know, 2 months, we ought to be able to have, you know, not only one meeting, but meetings and follow-ups and be in a position to really assess whether we've got a big gap, a disagreement, that is going to require formal discovery or not.
Let's say, like we say, then by the end of October, if you think it's doable, that you guys can have these informal discussions, of course. I know you've already had some. But that in that time period, that the applicant will organize a meeting where all the protesters can be available to sit down with Mr. Church and he can kind of talk through his report, give some more explanation, answer questions if the protesters have.
It would be nice.
Well, I would rather, I mean, not saying we don't do that, but I think we still need to have some one-on-one discussions that we haven't engaged in with Suez since they reopened this, or since the last fall. So I think we would want to do that first before we decided we wanted to figure out which little square in the compass had the wrong numbers in them.
Well, I think that makes sense, Alan. If there's a way of accomplishing that without looking at all those little squares, that'll avoid a lot of brain damage.
Okay. Well, if you guys can kind of spearhead that idea, have the informal discussions, but also before the end of October, if you can't solve things informally one-on-one, then you make Mr. Church capable of organizing a meeting where people can sit down. And so then I think beginning of November, we can open up a formal discovery period.
Could I suggest that we reschedule or schedule another status conference at that time and just check in with you so you know where everybody is? We can say, okay, we're moving ahead or we're getting close to getting this thing resolved, but still have the authority that doesn't happen to go ahead and begin formal discovery in November sometime after that.
And in fact, why don't we save the trying to define what formal discovery will look like until that status conference. It used to be a telephone status conference, of course, we're going to develop it together again at that point. I can provide an update of where we are in the licensing process too. But I think then at that November date, we can look forward and probably have a better sense of how much longer it may take to get the licensing done. Look forward, maybe beginning part of next year, set a hearing date that we can work towards with the understanding that may need to bump out, and depending on if we can get everything that needs to be done in advance of that. Any concerns with that? Just looking into early November for a SAS conference?
No, I think that sounds like a good path forward here.
Okay. We'd like to have it in person, so you have to drive over.
Well, I'm myself out here anyway.
I'm kidding. Of course, we could probably do it either way, whichever you prefer.
There may be some advantage, though, to having us. I mean, I think us sitting around this room today has been productive. And sometimes that allows us to communicate more effectively.
I'm looking at my calendar. I actually have a hearing in Boise. I'm assisting Nick Miller. He's one of our new hearing officers. I know you guys work with him as Western Regional Manager. He's starting to hold hearings for the department. So he has one scheduled on the 9th, and I'm just going to be sitting with him to assist. So I'd be able to meet maybe the afternoon of the 8th for a staff's conference and be here in person.
What is that look like for us?
It's a Wednesday the 8th.
But at some point, we had a whole date for
water board meeting.
For water board meetings.
I think it's going to be December, right? Yeah.
So other than that, both of our calendars are clear.
So water users is the 9th and 10th.
action you want.
So we could do it, if you're here, your hearing is on the 9th?
It's on the 9th, yep.
So I don't know how long you're going to go. We could do it, I could do it in the afternoon of the 9th or on the 10th. Instead of 4, we'd work better.
I've got the flexibility. I don't expect this hearing. I've looked through some of this. I don't know if you're involved in that hearing.
I am, yes.
Okay. Do you expect that to be a full day hearing?
I don't expect it to be a full day hearing.
Because we could do a 4 o'clock meeting here. For the steps.
Your hearing is here?
Hearing's out at Western.
It's at the airport office. So let's plan on that.
Is that, are we still on the 8th?
Let's do the 9th.
Oh, the 9th? Yeah, the hearing's the 9th, right?
The hearing is on the 9th. Yeah.
Yeah, that's great.
I may be speaking in North Idaho, but I think if need be, Mike Lawrence can handle the standards conference.
Well, we will set it up at 4 p.m. on the 9th, and of course, if something comes up and again, somebody can't attend, you can do that. We'll just wait for the telephone conference at that point, but because I'll be out here, we'll just meet in person right now. Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to raise while we have all the parties here?
Yes, Your Honor, there are 2 pending motions. They're both fairly trivial.
And you don't file a trivial motion.
I finally did. I filed a trivial one.
Is that sanctionable?
the most trivial is a name change or faction change, and then the second one is just for an identification of party status so that we can have clarity as to who's in, which side you're on, and a clear definition of the service list. And then the slightly trickier part of that is the suggestion that we explored in 2012 that maybe is less necessary now, but we explored the idea of having a service deemed to be complete if we serve that is electronically by email combined with putting it on IDWR's website. But we had more parties then, and maybe we don't really have to do that now, but it would certainly be a convenience to the extent that we still have a fairly long service list.
Do we have electronically for everybody? I guess we can find that out, didn't we?
For emails? I certainly have that, and I think there'll be relatively little change.
Okay. I don't have any objection to any of those suggestions or trivial motions.
Any other issues? I think our service list for this staff's conference, I think, reflected for the most part what you were proposing anyway, so I appreciate that update. And I will issue an order then approving both of these just to have something in the record to know that they were accepted and changes made to the caption, and also defining who the remaining parties are and who can continue to receive, I guess, the interested parties in particular. And some parties we've had that, of course, have just dropped out entirely. Chris had mentioned before the meeting that the city of Pocatello was one that recently said something is just withdrawing from the proceedings altogether. So I will issue an order here in the next couple weeks addressing both of those.
Your Honor, there are just a couple of other name changes, I think, that I can't really speak for, but others here may. It's my understanding that Gordon Law has retired. I think he's on the service list now. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so would it be just you, Richard, for the city of CUNA?
Yes, and I'll make sure it gets routed to the appropriate parties.
Okay. And Doug Strickling. Strickling? He's been replaced by Abigail.
Jermaine.
And then it sounds like there may be a couple of new folks possibly for the city of Boise, so I'll be making impact to the city of Boise Woods. Should the service list just be you?
At this point, but we'll update if that changes.
We've also included a courtesy copy list, so if you want to, you know, we're happy to provide additional courtesy copies, particularly if we can do that just electronically, so just keep us updated.
Thank you.
Yes. In the informal discovery process that that you folks have been discussing, the city would like to be involved, or at least listen in, if there is a global meeting where John Church is made available to discuss his report. We're not asking to be included in the one-on-one discussions that the parties might be having, but to the extent there's a global discussion where John Church is made available, the city would like to be in attendance at that meeting.
The city of Boise would echo that as well.
Very good.
Count numbers in
you guys make that.
Oh, it's really interesting, Al.
Anything else? Ready to throw questions while we've got everybody here? Okay. Kim, did you have anything that I've forgotten? Okay. Good. Thank you, everybody, for your time, and good seeing you.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.